We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You're a fan of hockey. A Flyers fan, right?
Correct.
Who's the toughest guy you've ever seen on the ice?
There's a few of them. As a Flyer or like NHL in general?
Would you be willing to admit that there's another tough guy outside the Flyers?
There's plenty of tough guys outside the Flyers. But like for my generation, growing up, the toughest guys on the ice, the current coach, Craig Berube, he was a beast. One of my favorite fighters. Dave Brown. Incredible fighter back. Actually, Dave Brown was probably the meanest Flyers fighter I can remember when I was a kid.
Any memory of him stand out?
Oh, God, yeah. He had a trick he used to do back before it was popular. His jersey was real loose, so whenever he was a lefty. So whenever he used to fight, he would be able to slide out of his jersey real quick so the other guys didn't have a grip, and he would just tee off on them. Tee off. And he was a big dude, heavy hitter. When I was a kid, I would sit in front of the TV. Okay, for every single Flyers game, VHS tape in the VCR, and I would sit like an inch away from the TV, and every time I'd think there was going to be a fight or the gloves would drop and there's a fight, boom, I'd hit record. So I have years and years and years and years of fight footage from like the Flyers teams from like the early 90s up to like the mid to late 90s. So I've stacks of incredible fights and brawls from hockey. That was the best.
So, yeah, I'm here with Jared Wiener, one of the most intense, tough-as-nails human beings I know. He's Philly through and through, like you heard. He's head of BJJ United, a long-time jiu-jitsu black belt with 20 years, almost 20 years, on the mat. A competitor who won and medaled at many of the biggest tournaments in the world. He's a coach who's changed lives, many lives, toughened those who needed to be toughened, and humbled those who needed to be humbled, and gained the respect and loyalty of many, many people in the jiu-jitsu world. You're not one to be easily stopped by injury, but one did stop you in the last several months. It's a complicated one. You suffered multiple concussions that led to post-concussion syndrome. Can you talk about the concussions themselves and what happened?
Sure. Like you said, this has been a difficult one, and it's unlike any injury I've ever experienced before, ever, and I've had a lot of injuries. I can't tell you the one concussion that possibly like started this track, because I remember I was diagnosed with one back in like 98 at Maxercise, and I was a blue belt back in the day. I hit my head on the mat and they took me to the hospital and they said I had a concussion there. And from the years of training jiu-jitsu and skateboarding and training some MMA, even like hardcore shows, like everything, like you name it, ice hockey, any contact sport I played, I probably took concussions over the years. So fast forward to July-ish of this year. All right.
Five months ago now.
I was training with Little Chris, getting ready for Little Chris, one of the black belts here, one of the coaches here. All right, a good friend of mine, one of the great, longtime BJJ United student. We were training leading up to New York Open. All right, I remember trying in that session a flying triangle on him. I think he had one knee up and one knee down, you know, arm holding flying triangle. I think I overjumped. And I remember hitting the back of my head hard on the mat and seeing that camera flash then, not thinking anything of it. We continued to train, and Chris actually put me to sleep in that role right there with just a basic X choke. I was trying to pass through it, caught me clean, and I finished asleep on knee on belly on him. And I remember coming back too, and we were just like, what happened? So we just kept training, whatever. And for like a few days after that, a week or two, I would always say to Chris and joke in training, I'm like, man, I still don't feel right from that day. I'm like, that day was weird. I wonder if it was from the choke. Mm-hmm. Not thinking about how maybe when I smacked my head on the mat, maybe that's what it was from. And we talked about it for weeks leading up. I was like, yeah, Chris, I still don't feel right. I tell my wife, I don't feel right. I wonder if that choke messed me up. I wonder if he messed up something in my carotid. I wonder if there's something blocking the blood going to my brain or whatever. So whatever. Kept training. New York Open was July 19th. Had two fights that day. Won the first match. Second match, fought a real tough dude who I never heard of. Brazilian guy. I think he's living up in Montreal. Never heard of him. Couldn't find any footage on him. Tough as nails. Good. That's another good lesson. You never know who you're going to run into out there. So right away, I was like, all right, I want to get this dude done quick. So I was just like, I'm just going to try to wrist lock this dude right from the feet. As soon as we touch up, which you know about that. All right. And I was like, I'm going to try to put this cat away quick. I want to go home. I want the gold medal. I'm done. Let's just go. So as soon as he grabs my gi, boom, I hit the wrist lock right away. But he dropped his level at the same exact time, which was cool because no one's ever done that before. So I had the wrist lock locked in, but it made it for him to have a perfect entrance into a single leg. Mm-hmm. And when he did it, instead of going sideways, I went straight up and straight down. So I landed on the back of my head once again, but hard, because I remember him lifting me like up. I was up. And I hit hard, saw that camera flash again during that match, and the rest of that match was a blur. I remember being down 2-0 there, and then he swept me again. It was 4-0, and I kept almost scoring. I was racking up advantages, but I could just never catch up. And he won the match, but I don't remember parts of that match. It was really strange, and I don't want to take the credit away from him. He was awesome, and the dude's a beast competitor. You know what I'm saying?
Was there any moment during that match where you were like thinking maybe I shouldn't continue this match?
No, never think that. You're in the fight. You gotta finish the fight no matter what. You know, that's just my mentality. I would never stop a match unless it was like there was possibly a limb hanging off or like something bad. You know what I mean? That's just what we do. We train hard in here. We fight hard in here. We smack heads with dudes in here all the time. Get cuts. We're bleeding. We keep going. That's what we do. So I didn't think of that. I remember at one point in that match, like there was about 2 minutes left, and I'm standing in the center because I watched the video too with my hands on my knees, like looking at the side, my guys. I'm like, what's going on? Like, so whatever. He wins. And I'm just thinking like, man, something's weird. Right after that match, like something's really weird. I don't feel normal. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, I think I'm getting sick. And I never get sick after training. Never. I don't think I couldn't even tell you the last time I puked or anything. I've changed just a long time. Go to the bathroom, dry heaving. Can't get anything up, dry heaving. The bathroom starts spinning. I remember people in there like, are you all right? And I'm just like sweating profusely. I'm just like, yeah, I guess, you know. I go home that night. I continue to throw up, dry heave, but write it off as I'm just getting sick. You know what I mean? I thought I was getting the flu. So whatever. Fall asleep that night. A few divs. Feel weird a little bit the next day, but no big deal. It was a Sunday, day off, and then right back to training Monday because we had Chicago coming up. Literally like less than a week later, I remember it being a Wednesday or a Thursday in here. I was training with one of my female students actually as a warm-up. Not many people know it was a female that did this to me. But I was training with one of my female students, warming up in an afternoon training session, and she just smoked me with a knee right to my jawline, like perfect shot. All right, and I was in the process of just doing like a light knee cut pass, you know what I mean? And it dropped me right to my knee. And I remember still holding her gi and losing all motor skills. I lost all my function. I remember being knocked out. And she's like tapping my head, like, are you okay? Are you okay? And I'm just like trying to talk. I'm like, I was like that, you know? And I came to and I was like, Kel, I think you just knocked me out. You know, I think I was knocked out. And she's like, you want to stop? I'm like, no, let's keep going. We're going to keep going. Got Chicago coming up. There's a tough room, all tough guys training in there that day. And then, after that session, it was bad. It was noticeable at that point that I didn't feel right. I was like foggy brained. You know what I mean? Like something was foggy brained. I was having like bad migraines, and it was serious, real serious. But me, I mean, you know me. You know me pretty well. You used to train here with me. We trained together plenty of times. You know I'm hard-headed.
Yeah.
And I still had Chicago coming up. I still had these things coming up. And that was what I was thinking instead of there might be something wrong. I need to go to the emergency room and get checked out. All right. So I continued to train. I had team day. Team day was like August 4th or whatever. Trained through that. And I had all the killers, real tough training guys from all over the country come in. So, of course, I got trained with these guys. They're my guests. So I'm battling these dudes for days. And finally, I think it was like August 2nd, maybe, or August 3rd. It was a Sunday. I was so messed up. I had no balance left when I was walking. I felt like a DUI when I was driving. I had this eye pressure. I was having these severe migraines. I went to the hospital. And they told me what the deal was. You know, they were like, yeah, I think you got back-to-back concussions, which could be fatal. Actually, I looked into that. They're like, man, you're lucky, like, you know, it wasn't worse, you know? So I'm like, yeah, okay. Concussion, bad. Take a few days, rest, you know what I mean? So literally, I waited a few days, and I went back to training again. And actually, I traveled to Guam. I traveled to Guam. I traveled to Japan. So I traveled like 30-some hours, like, getting there to referee a tournament. And I can't remember refereeing the tournament. Okay, and they said I did a good job, didn't make any mistakes that day. I have no clue how I got through that. I have no clue. That trip, and I love Guam. It's my favorite place in the world to go. I love Guam, but that trip was a nightmare for me because imagine the 15-hour time change when my mind wasn't right anyway. It was horrible. So I came home, and things started noticeably getting worse and worse and worse and worse. I stopped training. I haven't trained since. I'm still not training.
When you say worse and worse, what are some symptoms?
Okay. And I'm going to be honest with you. This is, you know, some of the stuff that I'm going through and have gone through. You know, I'm still not out of the woods yet. There came a point where I was so messed up from the foggy brain feeling and from the constant headaches that I didn't know if it was like reality anymore. I thought I was going crazy. You know what I mean? And I was like, is this going to be like this for the rest of my life? Right. I couldn't leave my bedroom, if that makes sense to you. I couldn't.
Out of fear?
I couldn't even get up because I was so dizzy and foggy. And I couldn't shower. I couldn't even get into the shower. I couldn't shave. I had a hard time hugging my daughter. I didn't come here for almost 2 months straight. It was very, very dark, very dark. People weren't believing me. Some people didn't even believe me that I was going through. They thought I was just being lazy and being, you know, and you know, like people who know me know I'm not like that. It came to the point where, you know, I have tons of firearms in my house. You know what I'm saying? And I was sitting, like, there were some nights because you couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep. My ears were ringing, everything. So I'm sitting there at night, literally for nights in a row, just staring at Glock 26, 9mm.
Thoughts of suicide.
On my nightstand right next to me. I'm just staring at it every night. I'm just looking at it. I'm like, you know, what would be worth, like, it was, yeah, the thought was there. You know what I'm saying? So I was like, nah, I put it away so I couldn't see it. Take the magazine out, clear it, put it away. Next night, boom, magazine back in, you know, looking at it. I'm just like, I'm like, what the fuck am I thinking? I'm not like that. I'm not like this. I have a daughter. That's what I got to live for. I didn't care about anything else except her at that point. Nothing. So finally, I'm like, I need help. I need help because this is bad, you know. This is real bad because the foggy brain feeling wasn't going away and my everyday functions were gone. I fell into severe depression because I couldn't train. I couldn't imagine going to train twice a day, you know, every single day to zero athletic activity or sports activity whatsoever. That's bad. That's real bad. So finally, I call one of my best friends, Pete, who's a black belt here also. And my dad knew what was going on. And Pete came over and he's like, come on, we're going to get you some help. And he actually removed all the firearms from my house. Pete was a friend who stepped up there and took all the guns out of my house.
Did you tell Pete about your thoughts? And
I let him know. I let him know what was going on. He's like, yeah, it's time to get these out of your house. You know, we can't even take this chance. You know, I told myself, you know, the thought was there, but I don't think I would act on it. But just the fact that the thought was there and I had all these guns surrounding me.
It's not you. It's not who you are.
It's not me right now. I'm off. You know what I mean? So Pete took all my guns out of the house, which is, you know, that's what real friends do. You know what I'm saying? I'm forever grateful. And my dad, you know, he came over. My dad was great. My dad was my straight up taxi cab every single day, taking me to my doctor's appointments, to the neurologist appointments down to South Philly at Rothman Institute for the concussion specialist, to my rehab up in Bluebell for the vestibular and cognitive stuff I'm doing still to this day, with a real cool dude named Dan, who's a great therapist, has been working great with me. So my dad was my taxi cab so I could start to drive again. And my mom started to do a little more research, and she was a little more understanding, because in the beginning she didn't understand too much. She thought I bumped my head. And she thought, you know, but the more she looked into it and the more she talked to people, she became very aware of what was going on and started to take it extremely seriously and became very supportive as well. Was buying me groceries, helping me grocery shop, doing stuff like that. So,
Did other people in your life understand? You were saying how they, you know, there's some people that were just kind of.
If they never experienced this, it's hard to understand for anybody. And I'm starting to understand that myself. If you never felt different for 5 months straight, 6 months straight, it's hard to comprehend how serious this gets and the depression that came along with this. It's unreal. Like, I'm making strides every day. You know, this fucked up my family. It broke up my family. All right. So we're working on that. I'm working now that I'm starting to come out of this to try to fix, if it makes sense, some of the damage that I did while I was feeling all fucked up. You know what I mean? And I didn't go out of my way to hurt anybody or say anything mean or do any mean stuff. But like, I was in such a place that it wasn't me, you know, and I'm still foggy brain. I'm talking to you right now, kind of foggy brain and stuff like
that. Have you had a single day yet where you're like, what you would think is 100%?
No, I forget what that feels like. And yesterday, believe it or not, I was telling, like, because I was at therapy this morning, I was telling my therapist today that that yesterday was a pretty good day. It was clear, you know, I was having some thoughts, like just regular, clear Jared thoughts. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I want to train today. Oh, I want to see Ellie today, who's my daughter. I want to be with her today. I want to be with everybody today. I want to come in here and hang out and kick it with the guys today and just have fun. You know what I mean? But being like this in this state and having to take now certain medications and these supplements all day to help with the depression and help, you know, it makes you appreciate life and the important things way more. You know what I'm saying? And I know, like, that I'm making strides. I'm able to get out of the house and do things. Now, I know I'm going to get better eventually now. I'm thinking on a positive level now, you know, instead of thinking I'm never going to get better. I'm going to be like this forever. I just want to jump off a building. You know what I'm saying? It's not like that anymore. Now I'm thinking, like, I'm going to get better. I'm going to come back to the mats. I'm going to beat the shit out of everybody again. That's what I'm thinking. But
so it looks like you still got your sense of humor.
I'm trying.
Is that there?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Do you see, like, the, you know, because the Jared I know, you know, you joke around a lot with the guys, and that, are you able to do that?
Yeah, it's coming back. And they say, like, when you're in post-concussion syndrome and you're in it for a long time, the personality just starts to come out a little bit, even though you're in this fog. You know, and I guess the personality is starting to come back out, and it's just kind of getting me by. Like, I'm back in here. I'm able to teach some class, have fun with the guys, bust some balls a little bit. You know what I mean? But yeah, there's some dark days, man. It was bad. It was real bad. Like, I couldn't cook breakfast for myself. I couldn't even get up and muster enough strength to pour a bowl of cereal or cook some toast or get my coffee. I was only in, and just like you, I love my coffee.
Yeah.
You know, but I was so worried about the coffee giving me that too much energy high or boost in the morning. I was drinking a little cup at a time just to still have my coffee fix. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was acting so weird and doing so much stuff that wasn't me. But, you know.
Was there something that was helping you get through, or is it just all dark?
Man, at one point, it was literally there was nothing. Nothing. Nothing was helping me get. Nothing. I was just having to be patient. I couldn't watch TV. I was light sensitive. My phone hurt me too much. Like, I couldn't, I shut the world off. I really did. And thank God I have a great, loyal staff here and a bunch of the teachers here who've done an amazing job stepping up, filling in for me while I was gone. You know, and now I'm coming back more. Like, I'm in debt to these guys forever because they kept the train moving. And literally, you know, while I was home, not being able to do anything. Billy Walk's the man. Billy stepped up, all these guys. But Billy specifically was running the desk, managing the school, teaching classes, helped. He was running errands, like doing this, doing that. Like, I love this kid. And you know, it's serious. But all these guys, all the teachers, Chris, Tom, Basketball, Mike, Dina, everybody's, you know, they've done great. I'm very appreciative.
What advice did you get from, like, the doctors, and maybe, I think you mentioned before, there's others who've gone through the same thing that you were drawing some advice from.
Well, believe me, I was drawing tons of my advice from Mike Thomas, who was one of Brad Court's purple belts. Mm-hmm. He's a killer athlete. You've trained with Mike before. Mm-hmm. And he can't even train anymore.
Yeah.
Because he had 8 or 9, he told me, documented concussions. And I feel for this kid. This kid was a special athlete in here. He was incredible jiu-jitsu, fighting MMA, doing his thing, hard worker, hard grinder. He reminded me of me, like, lead with your head. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And me and Mike talked about, he would call me on the phone. I would text with him because I know he's been through this, and he's, you know, he's at the point where it's the light at the end of the tunnel and he's able to live a normal life again. Obviously with not training and stuff, but like, Mike was helping coaching me through it. He was doing it. So Mike was real. He was awesome with me. So he was giving me a lot of advice. He kept telling me that, you know, you're going to feel normal again. You're going to feel normal again, you know, but it's not here yet, but it's getting better.
So there's no trick to it. You just
wait. There really isn't. Rest and listen what the neurologists and the concussion specialists have to say, because they deal with it every single day. I was watching, there's one interview or a speech I watched from a retired NHL player, Pat LaFontaine, who was a great, great player in the generation when I was coming up, all-star, incredible. And he had so many concussions. And there's one on YouTube that I would just watch every single day. And he was so articulate the way he was telling his story. And his story reminded me of my story to a T. And I was like, wow, but he's doing good. He's living a normal life. He's got a family. Same with Primo and Pronger and those guys. Same thing, you know, like – So just by watching those guys and their stuff on YouTube and their speeches and their, you know, that's helped me, that seeing that these guys can get through it, so can I.
Do you ever doubt that there'll be a day when you can train hard?
Yeah.
Have you come to acceptance with that possibility or no?
I say it out loud all the time. I jokingly to the guys, like, man, I hope I'll be able to train hard with you guys again. I talk to it. Excuse me. I was telling that to my dad the other day, and he's just like, you know, one day at a time. He's like, you never know.
Don't think that far.
Yeah, because not training hard is like not my vocabulary. You know what I mean? I don't train light.
Yeah.
I never train light. I hate training light. I don't flow roll. I don't do stuff like that. I hate that.
Yeah.
All right. When I'm training, I'm training. I'm drilling, and I'm training, I'm training.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We train from the feet. We start from the feet. We throw each other on our heads. Yeah. We pass with our face. We pass with our heads. We pass hard. You know, that's what I like, you know? Yeah. Train hard. And if I do start training again, I know I'm going to have to come back and possibly play a little lighter. But that's going to be – maybe, you know what? Maybe that's going to help my game. Maybe that's going to make my jiu-jitsu better. Step back a little bit and refine the technique a little bit more. You know what I'm saying? So we'll see.
But how has the way you see the world on the mat and off the mat changed?
Everything's changed. Everything. Like, I'm just starting to getting my interest back for jiu-jitsu. Like,
was there a time you didn't even care about jiu-jitsu?
During that dark time, during those months or whatever, I didn't even care. Yeah. I just wanted to be better. Nothing else mattered. I want to be better for me and my daughter. I wanted to be there for her. That's all I cared about. And that's all I still care about. My interest is coming back to jiu-jitsu. I'm starting to, like I said, show positions again. I'll put a position out on Facebook here and there and stuff like that. You know, JT was just here again. Wilson was here. And thanks to those guys too, Wilson and JT, who knew I was down and out. And their schedules are so busy. The first opportunity they can make it back over here to help me out and teach some classes for the guys they did. You know, that's loyalty. That's friendship. You know, and I'm indebted to those guys as well. But yeah. So everything's changed. All my views, all my everything. The things I used to think were important, they're not important. Getting mad at people over stupid shit, that's not important. I don't care. I don't care. I just want to get better. I want to have fun and be back to normal. I want to drink a beer. I haven't had a beer in, they told me because you can't drink beer.
Yeah.
Because or whatever. I love craft beer.
Yeah.
You know, and I haven't had one forever. So, and it's Christmas season. That's the season for the good craft beer right now. So, yeah, these are the little things.
With BCS, you can get irritable from stupid little, like you said, get mad at little shit, but really you do get more irritable at stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Do you deal with that?
Yeah, but, you know, I'm irritable as it is anyway sometimes. little things. More or less, you know, but I find myself actually not being as irritable because I just don't give a shit about the stupid little things anymore.
Right.
I don't care.
Yeah.
And so to me, even Billy commented on the other day, he's like, man, you've been way more mellow, you know, and that could be the medication that's helping me as well. You know what I mean? I'm not ashamed to admit, you know, that I'm on some meds that are helping me on some things. The irritability a little bit, but nothing like, you know, normal day.
What advice would you give some other people that might listen to this and they're going through the same thing?
Okay, know it's going to get better, number one, because that's what the guys were telling me, and I didn't believe it, but now I'm believing it because I am getting better. Don't be afraid to reach out for help, okay? I was too afraid to reach out. I didn't want to tell people what I was going through because I'm supposed to be the leader here. You know, I got all these students looking up to me and this and that. I didn't want them to see me in my weaker state. You know what I mean? You got to throw that bullshit to the side, all right? And maybe my weaker state is a state they need to see. So if they're going through the same thing, they're going to go get the proper help needed. If you smack your head around and you're not feeling right, go see a doctor. Go see a doctor. If, you know, go see somebody. Take the rest you need. You know, I regret – nah, I do, but I don't. You know what I mean? Regret training as hard as I did right after the first two head injuries. You know, but like you can't live with regret. And I firmly believe in that. You know what I mean? Everybody makes mistakes. You know, you fix the mistakes and move on. You know, but yeah, you will get better. Don't be afraid to reach out for help. Take the proper channels, you know, reach out to the right people. You know, if the first doc, if you don't like what you're hearing from the first doctor, go see another doctor. Man, I saw 100 doctors during this whole process. Because at first I thought it was sinus infection. Then I thought, you know, it was just paranoia. Then I thought it was anxiety. Then I thought it was just, you name it, eye doctors, specialists, neurologists, blah, 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 blah. Name it. So I saw a million doctors. I was driving my insurance crazy. You know what I mean? But you know what? That's what it's there for.
Right. Who was the first person you reached out to? Was it your dad?
I think, my dad, Pete, in the very beginning too, a little bit. I was like, Pete, I don't feel right, man. Something's wrong, you know, because I confide in Pete with a lot of stuff. I said, I've known Pete before jiu-jitsu. Like, he's one of my best friends from when we were young. But I was like, Pete, I'm not feeling right. I remember it was team day. And I was like, Pete, I'm not feeling right. Something's wrong. Something's wrong. And he's just like, what do you mean? I'm like, I don't know, but something's wrong. I'm like, I'm lightheaded. Something's not right. And I was right away. And I told Pete, you know, I told Sharon, obviously. But that's tough love right there. She's like, shut up. Go on. Get to work. Do your thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the anxiety was bad. The paranoia was bad. It was all bad. All the symptoms that come with it came with it.
Yeah.
It really did. It's not bullshit. The stuff that's documented out there, it's real. It's very real. If you think it can't happen to you, just go get hit in the head a few times. Yeah. It could happen to you. Yeah.
you really are one of the toughest dudes I know. And if you can bring somebody like that down, this is serious shit.
It's very serious. And the thing is, like, I don't look at myself like that. I look at myself as like an average Joe. I try to put myself on the plane with everybody else. You know what I'm saying? That's why I train with all my students. You know that. I'm one of those professors or teachers, whatever you want to call, that trains with everybody.
Yeah.
I'm not picky. I don't put myself up on some pedestal like, you can't train with me. This is my school. Nah, you're new in my school. Remember your first day here? I beat the shit out of you.
Yeah.
I wanted to let you know.
You tapped in your belly, and then you told me you can never tap
on. Yeah, you're in my house now. You know what I mean? Like, so I try to train with everybody. And, you know, I just try to be one of the guys. You know what I mean? And maybe it is what it is. I'm not the elite jiu-jitsu athlete. I'm not the best dude in the world, but I'm in the mat with the guys every day. You know what I mean? I try to put myself there with them and help with what I can help with. You know what I mean? And so that's important, that maybe they do see me in this state too, knowing that I can fight through this and get better, you know, and I can lead by example in that way. And by helping people in this matter, I'm still being a teacher, I guess, but in a different form now. You know what I'm saying? So
Let's go back a bit.
Okay.
You started jiu-jitsu almost 20 years ago in Philly under Steve Maxwell. And you're not ashamed to admit that.
No, man. The legendary Steve Maxwell. He started jiu-jitsu on the East Coast, man.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. He's awesome.
You were, what, like 16, 17?
Yep.
Tell me about that guy, the young J-Dub. What was on your mind? What were your interests? Who did you hang out with?
I was my boy Bean. Brian, who's a black belt here also, the legendary Bean, the guy, maybe you don't know him by name, but he's a guy with tattoos all over his head, his throat, his hands, his face, everything. He's one of my best friends from back in the day also, same generation as Pete. We would always be skateboarding together, and he would tell me, like, yo, man, I'm doing this martial arts stuff, this Gracie Jiu-Jitsu stuff, you know, and you got to come check it out. But I was just a skater in the streets, you know, and I was like, whatever, man, I'll hit you with my skateboard. I don't need that stuff. I'll punch you in the face. I didn't care.
You're damn good at it, too, right?
What was that?
Skating.
You know.
Yeah.
I
pretty good.
I was doing some stuff.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, it's okay. I was in some magazines, and I was in some videos and stuff. I was... You know, if I would have known that all these skaters are making this much money today, maybe it's the route I would have taken, but whatever. So finally, I was skating down Chestnut Street one day, and Bean was coming out of Maxercise. It was just coincidence, pure coincidence, because maybe if I didn't cross paths with him that day when he was coming out of practice, and I was probably skating down to Sub-Zero, because I remember the direction I was going from Love Park to Sub-Zero, because that's what we would go every day. I was like, yo, Bean. He's like, yo, Jared, this is the place I was telling you about. Come upstairs and check it out. I was like, okay, cool. So I went upstairs, checked it out. I was like, yo, man, these dudes are serious in here. Like, and I met Steve that day, and I was like, this dude's wild. I was like, look at this guy. He's wild. His ears are all messed up. I was like, Bean, what's the matter with this guy's ears? I never saw cauliflower ears like that before. And then I went back the next day. I was like, Mom, please, Mom, Dad, whoever, Mom, please, I want to try this stuff. Come down with me. Sign this waiver, please. I can't remember if Mom or Dad, but I was like, sign this waiver. You know, please let me get in here, because I wasn't 18 yet. And I went in there, and that was it, man. Never looked back.
It was that easy, that choice.
Got hooked that day, man. That day. Never looked back. They were like, I'll never forget that day. They were like, how are you going to escape if somebody's on top of you in the mounted position? And I was like, I was 135 pounds, thought I was a badass skater in the streets. I was like, hey, I'll just push this guy off and I'll get him off. And I don't remember who was on top of me. It might have been Aaron Hershorn back in the day, who was an old school Maxercise guy also. I don't know if you ever met Aaron back in the day, but also, the kid was good. He was good. And he got on, I think he had a ponytail at the time, right? So he's on top of me. I'm pulling his fingers, I grab his ponytail, trying to get him off, like pulling his hair, get him off me. And I think it might have been Phil back in the day. He came over and was like, no, we don't do that. We don't pull hair here. I was like, why, man? You said, you know, get him off you any way you can. You know what I mean? It's what I would do. And then I couldn't get him off me. You know what I mean? I was like, man, this is for real. You know, I turned my back. He'd choke me. He'd arm lock me. That same first day jiu-jitsu that everybody gets, you know, it's humbling. And that was it, man. I was there every day, every day.
Well, you met your mom, Dad. What was your relationship like with your dad?
It was good. My dad's awesome. It is. He's awesome. He was an athlete growing up, you know. Played professional baseball. Had that hardcore athletic mentality that, you know, he lived by the code, the sports code, especially in baseball. He was that guy that, you know, you did something wrong in the game, you're going to get hit with the next pitch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or if you talk shit, he's going to be the first one to charge the mound. And it, that maybe that's where I got that from, you know, that athletic code. You know, you live by that code. You know, you don't break certain rules. So when I played ice hockey growing up, it was the same way.
You played ice hockey?
I played ice hockey, yep.
How old were you?
I played all the way till I think I was like maybe a junior or senior in high school. So I was training jiu-jitsu, playing ice hockey, and skateboarding all at the same time. Yeah, the same thing. I was a goalie. And, you know.
Just the guy with, like, the most attitude.
Yeah, you got to be the leader, you know what I mean, the goalie. I got that mentality, I think, from my dad. Because, I got in the street fights and stuff. This kid, quite a few. And I'd be like, Dad, I think I'm going to fight this kid. Can you come ref? Just make sure no one jumps in, you know what I mean? Right. You know, you win some, you lose some. I get my ass kicked some days. I kick somebody's ass the next day, you know what I mean? But he'd be there. Yeah. He'd be there, you know, which is, you know, I don't know if that was right or wrong back in the day, but, you know, it was pretty wild.
So he had your back.
He had back, but at the same time, like, if I would get into a fight in school, you know, instead of being like, why are you fighting in school? The first question would be like, did you win?
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, yeah, Dad, I won. Or no, not today. He's like, well, what happened? And I was like, you know, I fought hard, you know, but all right, cool. Now you can't be fighting in school, you know? So, yeah, my mom was an athlete too. She was like a gymnast, and her father, which is interesting, my grandfather was a weightlifter, had world records at a certain time, and made the U.S. Olympic team for weightlifting when it was in Nazi Germany in the 40s. And him being a Jewish athlete was not comfortable to go compete in the Olympics when it was in Nazi Germany back in the day, which, you know, I always said growing up, man, I wish he would have just sucked it up and went. You know what I mean? No one was going to mess with him as an American athlete, but he just didn't feel comfortable. And his mother didn't feel comfortable for him going to Germany when it was run by Hitler and stuff back in the day as a Jewish athlete. So I take a lot of pride in that my grandfather was an Olympian, you know, or he made the Olympic team but didn't go. You know, I would have loved to him going and win a medal and shove it in the face of, like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but it's good. It's so I come from
it's in
a
your
good
blood.
Yeah, I come from a good Olympic back or not Olympic athletic background.
Yeah. So I hear there's also a little your music choice is pretty interesting too, right?
Yeah,
tell me about that a little bit.
My first love, I love hardcore music, you know. But growing up especially in high school, music, I think, is really one of the main things that made me get along with everybody, all different walks of life. I loved hardcore music. I love metal. So I got along with the metal kids, got along with the punk rock, hardcore kids, and I love hip hop. So I got along with the black kids, the white kids, the Asian kids, the Spanish kids. I got along with everybody, and I could talk shop with everybody, you know, when it comes to music, you know. I'd be like, yo, did you get the new Keith Murray back in there, the new Biggie Smalls back in the day, you know, the Craig Mack, you know. Nas back in the day, like Illmatic was one of the best records that ever came out, you know. But in that same conversation, I turn to my boy over here and be like, yo, did you get the new Madball record today? Did you get the new, you know what I mean? Or the new Sick of It All record today? So I just had it. Music was very, it was very influential coming up. You know, I went to a lot of hardcore shows. I was in a hardcore band myself. We played shows in Philly and all over the place. I remember we played the track. We played all types of stuff, you know.
Nice.
But that was cool. And I still go to shows to this day. When my friend's band's playing stuff in the area and stuff. So, like, you know, music is definitely very influential still to me, you know, like H2O, Madball, all these bands, you know, I love, you know. But now, like, I actually started getting into a little reggae. I started getting into, like, all types of stuff, you know. So, yeah.
And you know, you usually don't play music when you train.
We do. We started that a little while ago. So we play music every day here. From training. So it all kind of depends on the mood, you know. One day it could be Tribal Seeds. The next day it could be Terror. Then you got Madball. Then you got, you know, you name it. We're playing it, you know. So some Killing Time from back in the day. Then you got Underdog playing the next day.
Yeah.
And then you got Nas, or then you got whoever. Snow Goons playing this day. Q Unique playing this day. Vinny Paz playing this day. So it's like, you never know. You know what I mean? So it's cool.
You've medaled and won at some of the biggest tournaments in the world as a black belt. What do you attribute your success to?
First, let me clarify, like, I've medaled and won. Most of my success came in the Masters divisions. okay, after I turned 30. And that's very interesting to me because I had like a confidence turnaround for some reason during that time. Because, man, let me tell you, like I meddled. I won some stuff in the adult class because I've been a black belt, I think, since I was 24 years old mm-hmm. or 23, 24, 25 years old. I've been for 12 years now. Almost 12 years as black belt. Yeah. This year will be 12 years as black belt. Time goes fast. So I did medal and I did win some gold medals and won some super fights in the adult class. So I can't, like, people can't say, like, you didn't win anything in the adult class. I did. I did win stuff. But I had a hard time. I had a hard time because, like, I don't know if it was just luck of the draw. Like, my first bunch of fights in black belt, like, my first fight in Brazil against Leo Santos. Then I'm fighting Carlos Portuguese. Then I'm fighting Puga. And then I'm fighting all these murderers right off the bat. Like, welcome to black belt.
Yeah.
Like, whew, you know. But I needed that. I needed to get killed by those dudes in the very beginning to feel that level and you know, something to strive for. You know, so. But then when I started getting the masters, like, it became a little more fun for me.
Yeah.
You know, still very competitive because, you know, I lost a lot in masters also. You know, but for some reason, I enjoyed the six-minute matches more.
Yeah. Higher pace and just you keep a good pace, so
you can keep a good pace, but also you can't make too much mistakes. You know what I'm saying? Because like a 6 minute match and a 5 minute match now in senior one or master two, they call it, is hard to come back from. You go down advantage in a 5 minute match, and this dude knows how to play the game right.
Yeah.
It's a problem. So playing catch up in these short matches. So you know, I don't know. I enjoy it. I enjoy it. But what was the question?
Where you got the success?
Like my team, being surrounded by a bunch of great athletes in this room right here where we're sitting that could push me at an elite level, you know, and I'm talking about training with my students. I'm talking about training with guys that they'll come in and help too, you know. I got a good support system around here from other black belts in the area that will come in and we'll train together as well. But the majority of my training comes from my students, you know, and I have guys that have been training with me for before I opened up BJJ United from Maxercise days that have stuck with me through all these years. So I have guys that have become black belts, like white belt to black belt from here, from this school, from BJJ United, that are sick, that are insanely good athletes. You used to train here, you know how good these guys are, and they're hard-nosed dudes.
Yeah.
You know,
even the lower rank, from white belt to black belt.
Yeah. There's that select group of guys, the Nicky the Goons, the Steve Cavanese, the Nicky and Steve are brothers. You got Billy, Andrew. Yeah, Andrew's back for the holidays now. He's training out at AOJ now. You had Berman. You had all these kids were animals. And you got all these next generations of guys I have coming up now, which you don't even know.
Yeah.
They're just crushers. Bob Snyder, Tapia, Alex. Like, I can name Basketball Mike. Like, they're all so good. Kubecki, and even the females, like Dina. Dina's an animal.
Yeah.
And I train with her like one of the dudes. She's strong as a dude, and she's technical as hell, and she beats dudes up in here. Yeah. And I could call Dina over as one of my main 6 minute training partners, like for a tournament, you know what I mean? So like kudos to her and kudos to all the guys in here who are keeping the pace and helping push each other, you know, and little Chris, all of them, but Billy's the one right now who's really like, he's my best training partner. He's the one pushing me and helping get me better for sure.
I think it was JT Torres that said that you should be nervous before a good training session because you know, you'll be able to push. You will be pushed to the limit mentally and physically. Do you think high intensity, hard training sessions are essential to molding a competitor?
Yes, absolutely. And he's right. When we used to have those original tag team sessions here, first off, the name tag team started years ago before this tag team started. It was Thursday Afternoon Crew. For everybody who wanted to know what TAC team stands for.
Yeah, for people that might not know, you're the head instructor of BJJ United, but you're under the flag of TAC team.
Yeah, I registered that under the IBJJF for TAC team BJJ, so that's my team. But TAC team was Thursday Afternoon Crew, okay? That's where it came from. When JT was still brown belt, that's what started. JT, Jay Hayes, Josh Griffiths, me, Wilson, you name it, Hinato Teixeira was here, We'd have JoJo, so many dudes. There'd be like 10, 15 black belts. Daniel Tavares, mm-hmm. who's an animal. That dude's sick. Like, I love training with Daniel. And we'd have new guests every week come. So we just have this room full of killers. Talk about getting anxiety before a training session. Like, I'd be looking forward to it, but at the same time, I'd wake up that morning like, oh shit. I'm like, it's Thursday.
Yeah.
I'm like, all these dudes, I'm like, this is going to be murder.
Yeah.
You know, never an easy role, but
yeah, there's no way to coast to that session.
There wasn't an easy role. I remember, Brad Court too. Like, Brad Court was here. Oh, hey, Brad's a beast. All these guys are animals. Brad's still one of my awesome training partners too, by the way. I still train with Brad on a regular when we're both healthy at the same time, which is rare these days. We get together and train. Those sessions were sick, and those were the early days of tag team that everybody started to get better. Everybody started winning more. That was the time. That's what I was saying earlier. Like, it was a confidence thing. And once I started having that high level training every week, my confidence started to skyrocket. And I clearly remember as soon as those sessions started, winning started on the regular. And then once you start winning, you're like, I can keep winning. And that's when your confidence just builds. You know, it wasn't an accident. No way.
But given the what you're suffering through now, the concussion, how is that the way you see that path to being a champion and competition?
I don't see it right now. I don't see it. I don't. Are you talking about myself?
Yourself, and for yourself 10 years ago, if you were sitting down and giving advice.
Man, I remember saying, don't ignore the injuries as much, maybe. You know what I mean? Or you're going to be injured. You're going to be messed up. You're going to be hurt. You're never going to go into a tournament feeling 100% healthy if you're training hard. But I would say for myself at least, like, man, there's times where I should have probably sat out a little bit. Probably should have taken some days off. Probably should have, you know, don't push my students so hard to the point where they don't even want to train here anymore. You know, it's like tough love, you know what I mean? But you gotta treat people specifically different. You know, you can't mold everybody into one. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Like, how do you know that line?
I wish people would come and talk to me more. I wish people would let me know, like, cause you know, somebody's a competitor and somebody's not a competitor, you know. And the way I am now, it even changed a little bit from when you were here. Like, I would try to force people, not force them, but really try to push people to compete. Now I don't force anybody or you can't force anybody to do anything. Let me take it back. I don't try to pressure people into competing as much just because I enjoy competing.
Right.
Does that make sense to you? If I tell people,
even if the guy's real good and he'll probably kill.
But you know what? He can do just as good killing me in the room and helping everybody else get better. You know what I mean? I don't pressure people into that any longer because it's not healthy. If people want to compete, they're going to compete. If people don't want to compete, they're not going
to
compete.
That's such a hard question because, I just talked to Jimmy Pager and he was drag kicking, screaming to the mat by his dad for years.
That's how I was with my dad, like to the hockey rink and to the baseball field. I enjoyed playing those sports, but there was times where I didn't want to play.
Sometimes you do need to be.
Yeah. Forced. And I was that type of coach. I would try to drag you to the mat all the time. I would try to drag the guys to the mat. I would get pissed at you when you didn't show up for practice. Yeah. Remember that? Yeah. Like, I was like, come on. Cause you were a good talent. You should have been here with the guys that day. Even if you weren't competing, you should have been in here helping the guys that day. Right. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, I don't pressure anybody any longer because I felt like it was leading to the reverse. Like Billy and Dina, for instance, I was pressing them to compete so much that they didn't want to compete anymore.
Right.
But when I left these guys alone, they're like, Coach, you know what? I think I want to compete.
Yeah.
And to Billy being Billy, spurred a moment. It's like, Coach, I'm going to compete this week. All right, I'll see you later. I'm like, okay, cool. Good luck. Have fun. Dina, same thing. Coach, I'm going to go to Japan. I'm going to go to New York. And she's going to win.
Yeah.
She's doing good. Nikki the Goon, the same thing.
Yeah.
You can't force him to compete. He's going to come to me and let me know when he's ready. Because these people have jobs and lives and stuff too. They're not full-time jiu-jitsu. You know, I don't think I have anybody here that's full-time jiu-jitsu, maybe except Billy, you know, but he has a job here too.
Right.
So it's difficult. It's difficult. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to come off as somebody forcing anybody to do anything, because I'm the same way. When somebody tries to force me to do something, I become resistant. And then I don't want to do that anymore. And people could shut down like that. I'd rather them, hey, check out this YouTube video of this competition. Check out this tape, this competition. Maybe it's something you might enjoy. Check it out. If something maybe you're interested in, you want to compete, come talk to me.
Yeah. I mean, I have to be honest with you, though. I mean, I understand what you're saying. But for me personally, I would prefer to be pushed to the point where you're stressed and you want to quit. And
yeah. Well, I felt I pushed you pretty well.
You did.
I might have pushed you over the edge.
I don't think so. Not at all. Not even enough. It's just that, unfortunately, I came to jiu-jitsu late in life, like a lot of the guys you said you're talking about. So I had a job that was the source of a lot of stress.
Yeah, I just don't want to be the source of anybody's stress anymore.
Right.
You know, I used to really, back in the day, like when I first started my gym, even when I was a brown belt, you know, I was a drill sergeant in there. I really was. And Philly wasn't used to that yet.
Yeah.
Okay, it wasn't used to that. Maxwell was a drill sergeant, but in a way where open mat was optional.
Right.
Like he was tough in the room. He was hard. When training was training, it was hard. We had our own private sessions kind of like for the competition guys, where he's a drill sergeant. We did some of the best workouts ever. But honestly, when I started my own gym, I was a drill sergeant. I was hard on these dudes. Like, they weren't used to bowing in. They weren't used to the discipline. They weren't used to, this isn't a social club. This is jiu-jitsu.
Right.
We're here to train hard. And a lot of people hated me for that in the scene in the very beginning. They didn't understand why I was acting like this. They didn't understand why I was trying to instill more discipline into the room. Man, this is a martial art.
Right.
We're doing martial arts. We're trying to better ourselves. But sometimes I took it overboard. You know, I really did. You know, but that was also an insecurity. I'll be the first to say, as a brown belt still at the time, opening up a new school, I had to be the tough guy in the room. You know, these people didn't know who I was. Like, you had big, strong guys come in. So I had to try to put these dudes a check right away instead of learning how to talk to people properly. And, you know, I came off as a dick, you know, in the very beginning. I was very hard, you know, I grinded dudes out. I'd slam you into the wall, you know what I mean? Like, but that's all a learning process. That's a learning process. And over the years I learned, you know, I'm not going to run my business like that. I'm not going to run my classes like that. We still run them disciplined and hard, but I'm not going to belittle anybody in a room because they're not working hard the way I want them to.
Right.
You know, people come to martial arts training and come to jiu-jitsu to get away from that bullshit.
Yeah.
If they're getting bullied or yelled at in their work environment or in school or whatever, they don't want to come and get it from me. They want to come and train jiu-jitsu and have fun with the guys and the girls. And they, you know what I mean? Have fun with the team. So it's a learning experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people I felt like that I've insulted throughout the years, I've tried to reconcile with them, you know, either by email or if I see you in the street, you know what, man, I'd like to, you know, sorry for some of the stuff I said to you back in the day, you know, when I was young and when I wasn't too mature and I didn't understand how to run a school and a business yet, you know. And I've mended the bridge with some people. Some people I haven't, but maybe in time, you know what I mean? But I'm not chasing anybody down neither.
But that's incredible self-awareness.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you for saying that, opening up.
It's a learning experience. It really is. And the more I grew and the more I matured and the more students I started to get, I started realizing, like, man, you got to be more welcoming. You got to be nicer. You got to be, you know, you can't be a drill sergeant all the time. You save that for specific times when it's necessary.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I was doing it 24/7. Every single class, you know, and I have hardcore guys that stuck with me from those days.
There's a lot of guys that love you.
Yeah,
for sure.
But there was also a lot of guys who didn't just because of that. And I remember, but I remember this too. And this was one of the best lessons I ever learned as a school owner from my late friend, Joe Prioli. All right. Joe was a great, great role model for me when I first opened up my school, who passed away way too young. But he told me that if someone is not enjoying your school or someone doesn't want to be at your school, allow them to go quietly. Don't stalk them. Don't follow them around. Don't belittle them. Don't badmouth them. Let them go. Wish them well and let them go. Let them go. Because all it takes is one person to start saying the bad things that everybody remembers that. No one remembers the good stuff. You know what I mean? And Joe told me that back in the day. And I always try to remember that. You know what I mean? You don't train here anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with you. I could text you. I could call you right now. We're good. You know what I mean? I think we were good right away.
Yeah.
I think I was the one who even told you, you know what? This might not be the best fit for you.
Yeah.
You might want to, you know, try some other spots, but you're still my man. Yeah. And I remember we've been fine ever since. You know, and I wish
I never said a single bad thing about you.
No, and I know you haven't. And I wish I could have done that a little more back in the day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But because
still, I've never heard a single negative thing said about you.
That's cool. I appreciate that. But, you know, like there's people, but there's also personalities that just don't mesh. You know what I mean? And that's not my fault and that's not the student's fault or whatever. But sometimes personalities don't mesh. My personality might not mesh with your personality. You might not like what I'm doing. I might not like what you're doing. And sometimes that's not repairable. So it's the best bet for, you know what? Go your way. Find another school or a training environment that's better for you. But I wish you well as long as you're still training jiu-jitsu and enjoying yourself. You know what I mean? So these are a lot of the things I learned over the years that it's just, like you said, self-awareness. You know, you gotta fix the mistakes. I'm not the same 24-year-old, 23-year-old that opened BJJ United back in the day.
Yeah.
I'm 36 years old now. I'm a dad. I have a family. I have a big business. And you know, you just live and learn. You know what I mean?
Now, speaking of which, you are a dad now. You're a father now. How has that changed you?
It's almost indescribable, you know? I love my daughter more than anything in the world. And these last 6 months have sucked so much because I haven't been able to spend the quality time, the amount of time I want with her. You know what I mean? Because I'm suffering through this shit and I'm in a bed and I'm just I got covers over my eyes and you know, but oh my gosh, she's the best. The day she was born was the best day of my life. She is such a pretty girl. She's a beautiful girl. She's got such spirit and character to her. She's funny. She really is. She's a character. She's funny. She's a good cross of me and Sharon. She really is. And she's tough. She's a tough girl too. You know, I have her in here on Tuesday nights during kids class now. Yeah. And I just sit her on the mat, let her crawl around, run around during kids' class just to start to get used to the environment a little bit. And she's only, what, 15 months, you know what I mean? But she's starting to take notice, you know, seeing what's going on. But she's awesome. It's definitely a game changer.
Has she softened you up a little bit?
Yes and no. As, like, the overprotective dad, no.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, for those boys who are going to be trying to take her to prom one day.
Oh, man.
I'm pissed. You know what I'm saying? I'm still pissed. I say you know what I'm saying a lot, I think, but that's all right. And I'm going to have all the boys here from Guam. I'm going to have all my boys from all over having a barbecue that day.
Yeah.
You know, whoever wants to come pick up Elliot Prime is going to have to meet all the fellas. You know what I mean?
Can you talk a little about Guam, how you made that connection?
Like- well, I always had a connection with those guys, you know, and we became closer, much closer. Me and Coach Burt, Stephen Roberto, I first met him and Roman, who's the owner of Fokai Industries. I think the first time I met those guys was in Brazil, believe it or not, 2007 or 2007. I think it was 2007. They were there with Mike Fowler because Mike was living in Guam, teaching there, training there and stuff. And we met for the first time there, and I hit it off with those guys well. And then we met again in California a year later or two. And then, you know, we kept in contact throughout the years. And I think I fought in the Asian Open in mm-hmm. 2010 for the first time. First time I was in Japan, and I met up with those guys there, you know, and stuck with those guys. And then me and Bert started to become pretty close, you know. We became close, and our personalities are similar, you know. And then once again, I went to Guam for the first time. It was in 2012. And I think
what was that like?
Oh man!
First of all, where is Guam? It's like the middle of nowhere, right? It's far.
Yeah,
it's far.
In the Pacific. You know, yeah. It's far. It's like Lord of the Rings journey getting there. You know, it's around the world. But it's paradise. It's a beautiful place with beautiful people. That it, unless you've been there, it's hard to describe. But it to me it's my favorite place in the world that I've experienced. just because, you know, I have friends there that I consider family. And it's just, you know, Bert is like, you know, it's somebody I look up to. You know what I mean? It's even though, say, like, there's a – if you're looking at it through rank, through jiu-jitsu, whatever, I might be a higher degree black belt than he is. I might have got my black belt way before he did, but I look up to him as a mentor and a role model as well.
Yeah.
So we have a very strong connection. We, like I said, we became very close friends over the last few years specifically, and that's a friendship I cherish tremendously. And shout out to Purebred Jiu-Jitsu Guam and all the whole crew there. That's that's an affiliate of ours here too. So we're connected. We're affiliated with one another, and just good people all around. Bert and his wife Dara, and Roman and his brother Carlo, Tome Bash, all those guys. It's trying to get all the names in, you know. But I could go on forever about how awesome they are. But they hold a special place in my heart over there.
For sure. So your school, your team is family. I know that, everyone knows that, how close you are with the people on the mat. And recently you've lost one of your family, John Flight, after a long struggle with cancer. I mean, you banded together to support him through that time. Can you talk a little about John and his struggle and his passing?
That's a tough one, man. It still is. It's still fresh. It's a fresh wound. Because John's whole family trains here too. They're like, Gabe's here and his wife Amy's here and Rosie. They were all here yesterday, you know, talking. I see Gabe and I see Amy struggling, and we're all struggling too. We're struggling with them. And we went to see John in the hospital a few times when he was struggling with the cancer and stuff. And me and Pete, and Pete's John's best friend. Pete Harris is John's best friend from when they were childhood. Escaped together in Southwest Philly, representing the SWP. John, he's a fighter, man. Like, I don't – like, warrior, you know? Like, he was looking in the face of death for over a year straight. And stayed so positive and never let on to anybody, not even his own wife, of stuff he knew that was going on. Because he didn't want to upset anybody, but kept it positive, you know, just for his family and for his friends and everybody, and so inspirational. And you know, he was here at the school like a week and a half before he passed away. That's how quick it came. Came like that. Like, he was sitting up front in the normal chair, that last chair all the way on the right, right before the entrance to the mat where he would always sit. Watch Gabe train, watch class, shoot the shit with me, you know, ask me how I was feeling because I was going through concussion stuff, you know, ask me how I was feeling, not even worried about himself, you know. I was like, fuck how I'm feeling. Sorry to swear. How are you feeling? You know, oh, I'm fine. I'm here. I'm doing good. Doing good. Then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened. Like, he got some pneumonia and sepsis or whatever. And a week and a half later, John's gone. I wish I had so much more to say. I wish I wouldn't have let him go that day. He was here because that was the last time I saw him. And I never got a chance to say the things I really wanted to say to him. Because it was just another day that day. I was watching Gabe train, shooting shit, talking about jiu-jitsu, talking about punk rock and skateboarding and the normal things we'd always talk about, you know? And then he's gone. Then he's gone. And it really bothers me to this day. And I think it's going to bother me for a long time, you know, because we were good friends also. We would skateboard together outside of the school. We'd go to shows together outside of the school. And I, like, you know, I don't hang out with many of the guys outside of the school. And so he was one of the guys I hung out with. But what he did was rally a whole entire jiu-jitsu community. For a dude who doesn't know anything or didn't know anything about the jiu-jitsu politics, didn't know much about the jiu-jitsu scene, knew about here, you know, mm-hmm. Miraculously rallied the whole entire community together to like a nice unity,
yeah,
you know, which was magnificent. And it, you know, he got great support from everybody. He had guys come visit him from California. He had guys visit him from Florida. He had guys come. It was unbelievable. Just from the jiu-jitsu community who never met him before. You know, that's wild. That's cool. That one to come support him while he was battling leukemia. Yeah, it's crazy though, man. I there's so much more I wanted to say. He was buried in his gi, And he had the under his gi, he had the United We Stand, the BJJ United shirt on, which I didn't know. I knew he was going to be in his gi, but I didn't know he was going to have the team shirt on. So when I, at the viewing, when I walked up, you know, to greet the family, I saw it. I lost it. Because at that point, like, I realized I always knew how much this place meant to him and his family, but being one of his wishes, like, that our school's name with him till the very end. Talk about loyal to the end. You know what I mean? Like that I lost it. I lost it. And you know, these are the things, like, it's hard to describe, but I miss John a lot. I was thinking about John a lot yesterday. I miss John a lot, you know, and the whole team and everybody, the community is here for Gabe and Amy and Rosie. Like, everybody, we're here for them and we're always going to be here for them, you know, because it's important, you know. Yeah.
You have a collection of photos that you've taken over time. You call highs and lows. Mm. Yeah, you're on Instagram at JW_street photos, and it captures the grit and struggle of Philly streets. These are my own words. Sorry if they don't hit the spot.
No, it's okay. It's good. Well done.
So one of the guys on Instagram asked you how you're getting so many great shots, and they are great shots. And your answer to the guy was patience. Can you describe your process? Like, where do you look? What do you look for when you take these shots?
This is cool. I'm glad we can talk about this, because this was one of those topics that I never combined too much with my jiu-jitsu life. Mm-hmm. This is always something I kept a little separate, you know, because I didn't want to be judged by anybody for being in the streets, you know, or even when I was a police officer, I didn't want to be judged by the other cops that I'm taking photos in the neighborhoods of stuff that's not very pretty. Yeah. But to me, it is. Some of these structures and neighborhoods and stuff that I'm capturing, these homes that are now all abandoned and boarded up all over, north, south, northeast, West Philly, South Philly, you name it, the whole spectrum of the city, have so much beautiful property. The Strawberry Mansion section of the city, unbelievable, huge Victorian homes that are boarded up from top to bottom for 10 blocks straight, that it's breathtaking to see that. It's like a ghost town, you know? To me, it's beautiful. And I enjoy being in the streets. The streets tell a lot of stories and tell a lot of struggle, but also tell a lot of success. And as an officer, which I don't want to get too much into, I focused on the drug aspect of things also. When I was an officer, that was my primary focus. And believe it or not, by being in the streets so much, doing photography, which is a strong passion of mine, helped me with the job. Because I familiarized myself with the neighborhoods, where the drugs were coming from, who was using them, the kids that drove from the suburbs every day down to Kensington or whatever part of Philly they were buying their heroin, and which is an epidemic, which is horrible. And it's affected everyone from my family to, you name it, everybody. I got plenty of people in here who are recovering from some stuff, and you need to support these people. This is an epidemic. You can't just look at them and call them junkies and chest poke them and beat them down. You know, you got to help people. And I capture these images. I capture them. But like, it helped me with the job. And I enjoy being in a neighborhood capturing images, because this is the stuff, these pictures that I'm putting out are respectful, number one. I'm not insulting anybody, which you saw. I try never to insult anybody. But I'm catching stuff that a lot of people like to shelter their children from, or shelter their teenagers from, or shelter, you know, people from the other side of Cheltenham Avenue where they don't need to see that stuff. Now, everybody should see that stuff, because we're sitting in Jenkintown right now, but if we drive 2 miles down the street and cross over Cheltenham Avenue, we're in some rough spots. You know, and everybody needs to be aware of your surroundings, and there's beauty in that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So a lot of your shots are abandoned buildings. There's like an eerie sky overhead. In one sense, it's like hopeless. It's like you capture hopelessness.
Right.
But at the same time, there's you also have these characters that pop out. either it's writing or it's people. There's something like really human, like funny, crazy about them. And it's almost like they, you know, even in this poverty, people still flourish. Like, and you capture that, like that.
I love street photography. I love shooting the buildings and structures, like you said. But I prefer to shoot the human aspect because it really tells a good story. And often, not every time, but I'd say 85% of the time when I'm shooting a human subject, shooting by means of camera shooting, not shooting, I try to talk to them. I try to get a backstory. I want to know how long you've been out here on these streets for. I want to know how long you've been using for. I want to know what your story is. I want to know where you came from. I want to know if you were in the military, like a lot of these people were, who are forgotten. You know, I want to know where you came from. Are you from the city? Were you from upstate New York? And did you get lost in the city just trying to buy drugs and you never left? Blah, 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 whatever. But yeah, I try to humanize it. I really do. I don't try to demoralize anything or anybody. I want people to see this city in a different light in an artistic way.
And what is – so behind all that abandoned beauty and all these people, there's drugs? Is drugs behind everything here?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's behind everything, but drugs is definitely a part of it, you know. And like I said, when I was a cop, yeah, people were getting locked up, people were doing this, but at the same time, the majority of the kids, and I say kids because these were kids, like we're talking like teenagers and young 20s that I was catching with needles and heroin and stuff like this. Like I'd meet them in court, do this, and we'd try to get them drug rehab. I had a good judge at the time who was kind of on the same page as I was, and he saw the struggle these kids were going through, and we saw the parent struggle that these kids were going through. Mm-hmm. You know, and it broke my heart to talk to some of these parents, and I would try to help these kids. Like, you know what? Okay, this is the first step in the right direction. Sorry we had to meet like this, but let's try to get you drug court. Let's try to get you rehab, and you know, here's my work number. You know, give me a call. Let me know how you're doing. You know what I mean? And you'd be surprised how many times I'd either run into these kids on the street again or get a call even to the station when I worked there. Like, I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you. Or the kids would show back up to court months later and be like, oh, I'm in rehab right now. I'm clean 8 months, 9 months. I'm like, cool, man. That's awesome. Let's drop this case. Right. You know what I mean? Let's, you know, and that's the part I liked. I liked that. And, you know, I have family members that got wrapped up in some stuff. So I kind of took it personal, you know, and I have plenty of friends that, you know, are still wrapped up in stuff to this day. You see them like kids I went to high school with or people I know from jujitsu or whatever, you know, you see them on the streets, you know, like, man, what are you doing down here? You see track marks on their arms. Oh, I'm working down here. No, you're not. Don't lie to me. You know, and you got to help these people. You can't step on them. So you just got to be aware of the situation. And Philadelphia it's bad. It's bad. I mean, you would come and go, you know, taking public transportation sometimes. Yeah. So you would see it with your own eyes. You see it even on the buses. Yeah. The people knocked out, knotted out, and stuff like that. But, you know, I was into helping people, man. When I was out there working, I wasn't into chest poking people. I like to communicate with people and talk to people, you know. Just because I was in the streets so much, probably coming up, it probably made me better at what I was doing, you know. But I just couldn't find the time between my business and working the streets and all the court time and the stresses of that job, you know. So I chose to just focus on jiu-jitsu. But it's a tough job, man. It's a thankless job, you know. And I respect the guys and women out there doing it properly.
Yeah. You know, I got you.
If that makes sense to you, properly.
100%. Is there one shot that is most memorable for you?
What do you mean, photos?
Should I stop saying shot? To clarify, every use of the word shot is referring to photography.
Yeah, yeah, there is. There is one shot that's on that Instagram feed, the JW Street Photos. It was a shot I captured in a really bad neighborhood in the Badlands of a guy walking. It was a black and white shot I took, just him like – I don't even think he knew I was there, to be honest with you. And it was a cool shot, and we nicknamed that shot Pure Evil. because that was the face he had on him at the time. Just like pure evil, drug addict, you know, a guy who was using. So I was like, you know what? Like a year later, I'm like, I'm going to find this dude on the streets and I want him to see this photo. Sure enough, I found this dude like a year later holding a sign at like being Lehigh or something like that, you know, right there, right where it starts getting gritty. And I called him over. I was with my buddy Nick at the time. Me and Nick called him over and started talking to him. His name was James. Got a real name. All right, got James's whole backstory. So I was like, James, I want to show you something. He's like, what's that, man? I was like, check out this photo. I pulled out the print. You know, I had the print with me. He's like, oh my God. He was way skinnier at the time. You know what I mean? He's like, you took this? I was like, yeah. I was like, actually, this photo got some recognition at a show. And you know what I mean? No one knew your name. No one knew anything. And he was like taken back by it. And then he's like, man, let me autograph it for you. So he did. He autographed the print and then he held it up for me. And I took another photo of him a year later holding that print for me. And that's on the feed also. And that there was like one of my most memorable shots, because I thought that was like the one shot turned into like two good shots and a really tragic but good story.
Yeah.
You know?
He made it out from wherever he was.
No, he's still, I'm sure he's still in those streets. I haven't seen him for a while, you know. I'm not in the streets that much, but, you know, I haven't seen him. So, yeah, I hope he's all right.
I'm going to put you on the spot. You got a bunch of tattoos.
Right.
I think tattoos capture, you know, where your mind was when you got it in that moment of your life. So at this time, what is your favorite tattoo and the one you draw the most meaning from?
There's a lot, you know. I have the ones on my hands here that say adapt and overcome. They mean a lot to me, especially in the times I'm in right now, you know, and some of those darkest hours we were talking about earlier. Like I would remember that, like, yo, I'd be a punk, man, if I did something stupid to myself when I have adapt and overcome on my, it's like hypocritical.
Yeah.
So that kind of motivated me a little bit. So I love those. They mean a lot. All my tattoos have a story. I have the one I got permission from Bert in Guam. I got the Yamato Damashi tattoo on my arm up here. You know, that one's got a lot of meaning. I got so many. Like, yeah, they all have their own meaning. I got the samurai scene over here. Mm-hmm. I got all types of old traditional stuff over here. You know, you name it. Everyone's a different time of my life, you know.
Adapt and overcome. That's a good one.
Adapt and overcome. I love it.
Can you tell me where people can find you online and in person?
Yeah, I recently reactivated my Facebook because I was off Facebook for a while. But you just look up my name on Facebook. You can find me.
And Instagram?
Instagram, the JW Street Photos, JW Street Photos, JW_Street Photos. That's my art gallery. I consider my art gallery that I put a lot of effort into that also. And now that I've been down and out, not training as much, I have more time to edit a lot of my photos and stuff. So you check that out.
So I have to take this moment to thank you personally, man to man. Maybe I need a mic in front of me to be able to say it. But the blood, sweat, and tears you put in all of your students, of which I was truly proud to be one for some time, made a big impact on my life. Thanks, Jared, for all that.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
And thanks for having this conversation today.
Yeah, definitely. It's an honor. Thanks for having me, Lex. I'm super stoked to be on your show or on the podcast. Good we get to sit down and catch up and talk, you know. I hope everybody takes what I say to heart. You know, there's no act here. What you're getting is me. Can I thank a few people too?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I'd like to thank the people who have supported me through this, which is all the people I mentioned who have supported me through my I don't want to call it hard times, because there's people out there who are going through way harder times. And I, you know, I don't like to make excuses, but the people who have really supported me through this post-concussion situation, thank you. You know who you are. And I probably named you throughout this, so thank you. The companies that have stood by me and still have faith in me, that believe in me, that I'm going to come back and still be an active jiu-jitsu competitor, or just allow me to rep your name, show your role, thank you. Fukai Industries, thank you. My family, Pitchfork, New York Hardware, thank you. Glenside Tattoo, Duke's Barber Company, Thank you. You guys rule. You're all family to me. Thank you. And Casa de Rock, check out my boy Hoya's new clothes gear, his t-shirts. He's sponsoring me too now. Casa de Rock, check him out.
Thanks, Jared.
Thanks, Lex.